think there are times when it's actually pretty fair, is they claim that followers of Jesus do terrible things. You hear stories of people who are members of a church, who profess to be Christian, and then are always losing their temper around others, or manipulating the people closest to them, lying about something he's selling to get a better deal, or insulting people often. What's worse, today we often find Christians who don't act like Jesus at all because of politics, because of family first only attitudes, or even minor biblical convictions that are elevated to primary ones. I've heard of Christians who've cheated people when selling a car, who've stepped over people at work to get ahead in a career, and have been the worst kinds of neighbor in a subdivision. These things are embarrassing for the Christian, no doubt. It's even embarrassing for us who represent Jesus here as his church, but ultimately it's embarrassing for Jesus himself. How terrible is it that we might be prone to say how important biblical love is in the Christian life, but instead of being loving ourselves toward others, we save all of that love simply for ourselves. We rightly reject the social gospel of acting like Jesus is the way of salvation, but use a right doctrinal stance to justify ignoring the poor. Jesus was crystal clear about this. You only have to read his parable of the Good Samaritan to know what he thinks about Christian compassion. And I want you to listen to me, friends. It's not enough for us to be friendly. We have to be loving. It's not enough to have good doctrine. We have to be loving. It's not enough to have sacred music. We have to be loving. It's not enough to have right standards on worldliness. We must be loving. We should ask of someone who claims to be a Christian, how can you make such a claim and not act like Jesus on this point? What did the Apostle John write? If you claim to know him, you must order your life as he ordered his life, 1 John chapter 2. You have to live like him. No one was a better friend to the poor, the indigent, the outcast, than the Lord Jesus Christ. Do you remember the Jerusalem Council that met to talk about the gospel? And after they had this discussion, and these were the apostles, the luminaries of the early church, after discussing the gospel, they gave out a decree which ended with this sentence, "Only remember the poor." That was the conclusion. This was one of the main points. Remember the poor. And Paul said of that, which was fine because we were already doing that. Listen, Christians must have compassion, or else I will say they're not likely to be truly Christians. And this passage in James is one of the most debated in scriptures, not because of the whole importance of compassion, but because of how it approaches the subject of faith and works. But unfortunately, because of that debate, Christians have concluded it's actually okay not to have compassion on others. I recently asked Pastor Joe to do some work for me for the class that I was teaching in India on the general epistles. It was kind of a last minute thing. I found I was going about 2 months before I left. And so I was doing work on some areas of that subject, and I wanted him to do some technical work in other areas. And so he helped me here and compiled some information, and I thought it was so good that I wanted to give you his notes, okay? So this next little bit, Pastor Joe compiled. He writes that some Christians come to this text and think that James is contradicting Paul. Specifically, by the way, I'm summarizing what he wrote. So, specifically, Romans 3, Galatians 2, and Ephesians 2. Martin Luther, at least at one point in his life, considered James to be, quote, an epistle of straw, end quote, because of this controversy. And basically the controversy is this. It appears from James that he is teaching that salvation is faith plus works. Now that's the Catholic view. And I say that because they actively teach today in Catholicism that this text proves that it is faith plus works. Of course, Paul teaches that salvation is by grace through faith without any works, lest any man should boast. And that's our view. That's our opinion and position. So what do we make of James? He says here, faith without works is dead, being alone, and that a man is justified not just by faith, but by his works. So what do you make of this? There are three major views. That James disagreed with Paul and was seeking to correct him. That's the first view. Or even vice versa, if you believe Paul wrote after James. Or number two, James corrected a misunderstanding of Paul. So people were reading Paul, they didn't fully understand what he meant, and James is now clarifying what Paul meant. Or number three, that James and Paul address two related but also distinct issues. So in James 2, this passage, 14 through 26, it doesn't explicitly mention Paul at all or even delve into the doctrine of justification by faith. Now here's what Joe writes. In Koine Greek, nouns are typically introduced without an article, but subsequent appearances include the article. Now, an article is like the word the. So it won't have the article, but then later will include the article. Referencing back then to the initial noun. So you've got a noun, then later you have the article, and you know then that that noun is talking about that first usage of the noun. So if this is a phenomenon known as the article of previous reference, and you see it right here in this text, where James says, look at verse 14, what does it profit, my brethren, though a man say he have faith, okay, and have not works? The next phrase, can faith save him, would probably be better translated, can this faith save him? So there's an article there. And in fact, some modern translations, the New American Standard and the ESV, actually say, can that faith save him? Now, when you examine the surrounding context, it clarifies James's argument because he's comparing faith without works. So that's a faith. I believe this. But it doesn't produce anything. To words without actions. Or I would say it this way, and this is the way I was talking to my students. If you thought or believed, you truly believed that the ceiling would fall down upon us in the next 5 minutes, what would you do? If you really believed that, well, let's see. Let's turn on our timer and let it play out. I mean, how many people would do that? Nobody would. If you didn't leave the room immediately and grab all your children, you know, by the hand, then you either are someone who doesn't believe the roof is going to cave in, or you're crazy. Because if you believe in something, you are going to act on that belief. So, faith without works is like words without actions. Mere words do not alleviate the situation of hunger and nakedness. So you got the needy brother, and we give him a platitude. The one who has his needs met has his situation changed. So faith, apart from works, apart from actions, is a platitude. It's just empty words. James asserts that faith, accompanied by works, is what we call saving faith. This echoes the faith of Abraham, validated through actions. Faith followed by works aligns with broader New Testament teachings on justification by faith, not solely Pauline doctrine. The individual James describes in 2:14 is familiar to us, a person who has a profession, even holds correct beliefs in doctrine, but does not ever live it out in his daily life. And James censures this faith, emphasizing that it faith that has no works is actually empty. It's worthless. Won't you know this, O vain man? It's worthless. It neither sanctifies nor saves. True saving faith, as James emphasizes, is one that manifests itself in actions shaping one's way of life. And then Joe goes on to show that Paul agrees with James. Faith is necessary for salvation. That's James 2:18. And he compares that to Ephesians 2:8 and 9. That faith without works is not saving faith. James 2:17. And then he says, go look at Romans 1:5, 1 Corinthians 15:2. And that saving faith is always accompanied by works. James 2:24. Compare that to Romans 3:31 and Ephesians 2:10. So what I want you to see here is that if you say you have faith, if you say I believe, then it ought to result in something. And the context of this passage makes it clear that what our saving faith does is that it demonstrates itself in compassion for needy people. So here's point number one. All right? Point number one. Unsympathetic Christians are not Christians at all. And that is a very harsh statement, but I think it's true. Authentic Christianity includes compassion for needy people. The entire argument that James is making is based on an assumption: real Christians do not act this way. What does it profit, my brothers, if a man say, I have faith and doesn't have works, can that kind of faith save him? And the answer is no. If a brother or sister has no clothing and no food, and you say to him, feel full, feel warm, but you don't actually ever feed him or clothe him, what profit is there in your faith? You see, followers of Jesus respond to life crisis like Jesus did. He always cared for people. He always provided for their needs. And the question in verse 16 is basically saying, this is an impossibility to have real, authentic, genuine faith means to do what faith does. Faith in Jesus always produces works like Jesus' works. And this all follows on the heels of the situation of the two men in church. Remember, the man comes in wearing really nice clothes, and the man comes in wearing rags. And the rich and poor were being treated differently in the church in Jerusalem, the rich man being treated well, the poor man being treated terribly. And James responds to that by arguing that this kind of partiality is a violation of the law of love, and ultimately an indication that this person who claims to be a Christian is giving an empty profession of faith. Because, letter B, a lack of compassion is evidence of false faith. Claiming to be a Christian while not living like a Christian is a hollow profession. Consider James's rhetorical questions. Is there anything worthy of faith that is never accompanied by actions? And if it hasn't have actions accompanying it, is this kind of faith really saving faith? And the obvious answers to James's rhetorical questions is no. That's not real faith. As Joe wrote, it's an empty platitude. A fellow Christian who is incredibly needy comes along. He lacks proper clothing. He doesn't even have food to eat right now. And the unsympathetic Christian says, be warm, though he has no clothes and feel full though he has no food. I was walking out of a bakery in Dimapur last week, and I was trying to find breakfast. Apparently, in India, nobody eats breakfast. I didn't know this. You can't find anywhere where you can get eggs and an English muffin or something. I'm nowhere. So I found a bakeries, and they would have baked goods. And some were wonderful and great, and some were not as wonderful and not as great. I walked out of a bakery, and I had a coconut croissant kind of thing. It was a little crunchy, had a coconut flavor. Patrick loves that. He loves coconuts. He can't think of anything worse. Had magic shell all over it. No, it didn't. You know that's made with coconut. Anyway. So I walk out of there, and as I turn and walk into the street, there's a man sitting there. All of his limbs are deformed. They're either missing or they're really incredibly short. And he's just sitting there on the sidewalk. And I looked at him and I said, hold right there. I turned around and I said, I want another one. I bought another one and I handed it to him. I said, have this. Eat this. Pastor Tia told me that the way that people were greeted in his tribe, Nagaland is really interesting. It's kind of not part of India, even though it's part of India. Assam and Nagaland, they're on the other side of Bangladesh. The people don't really look Indian. They don't act Indian in some ways. He said that the way they would greet people when he was growing up was not with good morning. The common expression, and I remember in school learning, good morning. This is how you greet people. Good morning. I don't know if it was first or second grade. I remember the teacher talking, this is how you greet somebody when you see them in the morning. Good, you say good morning. The expression that their tribe would use is, have you eaten? Every day, your good morning is, have you eaten? And I said, that is really weird. Why would they greet each other that way? And he said, because most of the people would not have eaten. They wouldn't have had enough to eat. Now, we have first world problems here, right? We live in a, and I don't think we should be ashamed or embarrassed of the fact we live in a first world. It's the way it is. In Paul's day, he lived in the first world of his day in the Roman Empire. It doesn't mean we don't have poor here and needy people here. But you understand that the poorest people here are rich people there. I asked two young men to grade my final exams. I gave out a final exam. I said, I'm leaving Friday morning. I won't be able to be with you students. So I have a final exam to give you. And I said, I need two volunteers to grade the papers. It's going to take you some time. And nobody wanted to volunteer. I said, come on, I need two guys. Just take one for the team, volunteer. I need two guys. And one guy, he's pretty bright student. He raised his hand. I said, really good, I need one more guy. Another guy, also pretty bright, raised his hand. I said, now I want you two to come up here. Now here's the problem. I had all this cash left over. I had changed in a $100 bill. So I was flush with cash. And by this point, I had spent as much of it as I could. I didn't have anything else I was going to possibly buy, and I still had like 2,000 rupees left. Now, 1,000 rupees is about $12. And I had them in $500 rupee notes. And so I brought the two boys up in front of the class, and I said, now, this is a lesson for all of you. You should volunteer, especially when someone like me says, I'm looking for a volunteer. So I reached my pocket, I pulled out these bills, and I gave $500 rupees to the one young man and 500 rupees to the other young man. And the first guy took it, smiled, thank you, put it in his pocket. The second guy said, no. I said, no, you volunteered. You will be grading the papers. You know, it's not, you're going to do the work. but I'm paying you for doing the work. And he began to cry over $5.56. Because for him, that's a lot of money. A lot of money. Now, you can't look at a person who has no clothes and say, be warm. And then turn around and say, but I love Jesus. Or look at a person who has no food and say, be filled. But I have Jesus. So during the week, I was thinking about this sermon for a while. I found a men's clothing store that I thought if I lived here, this is where I'd shop. Louis Philippe. Apparently it's an Indian clothing store. And I walked in and said, this is pretty nice. So I bought myself two shirts. And they were on sale, 40% off. So it came to about $15 American. And so I put it on one day, and Pastor Tia, my host, said, well, that's a really nice shirt. I said, would you like one? He goes, are you serious? I said, yeah. Would you like one? And I said, you know what? Let's do it. Let's buy a shirt for all the boys. So this wasn't church money. This is my money. I bought them all a shirt. You wouldn't believe how happy they were to get a shirt. A brand new. And Tia goes, this is the nicest shirt they'll ever own. It's $15. Now there are 18 of them, so it did kind of add up. And then I had two other boys who wanted in on it. So, you know, by the time I ended up buying 22 shirts at $15 each, I was going, okay, all right. So now I got to call Becky and explain to her why this bill's coming through. Then there were four girls there, and I felt sorry for them. So I went and bought them watches. Do you know the watches were like $12 each? I bought his wife a watch too. She didn't own one, never had a watch. So I bought her a watch. Hers was about $18. And the whole time, thank you so much. Thank you so much. And I'm looking at them and going, you have no idea. This is nothing. I'm so glad to do this for you. Friends, if we don't have compassion on people who are less fortunate, then it's impossible for us to say, but I'm a follower of Jesus. It's impossible. And yeah, a few $100, I guess I'll miss it. I don't know. I've forgotten about it mainly already. My wife will bring it up to me one more time. What budget do we take this out of? You know, that question will come up. But then it's fine. And it's fine. But they'll never forget it. They'll never forget it. And James argues that if we have no sympathy, that we aren't Christians at all. And he does so because saving faith always produces good deeds. Always. This is point number two. That right actions prove that faith is genuine. If a man says, you have faith and I have works, show me your faith without works, I'll show you my faith with works. And he's contrasting two confessions. The one who says, I have faith, and the other one who says, I have a faith that produces works. And you'll notice, by the way, verse 18 is not works without faith. It's, I'm showing you that I have faith by works. It's not the works that's the saving part. It's the faith that's the saving part. But the saving faith always produces works. So he demonstrates his faith. What something that I can't see. I can't see faith. But I demonstrate it visibly by doing something Christ-like. This is what salvation is meant to produce. This is what Paul argues in Ephesians 2, 8, 9, and 10. For by grace are you saved through faith, and not of yourselves. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. For we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus unto... There you go. And read through Titus and see how many times Paul says Christians should do good works. But not to confuse anybody, he says, not by works of righteousness, which we have done, but according to his mercy, he saved us. So I'm saved by faith and grace of Jesus through faith. But my salvation, my faith produces works. And then he gives us three examples. That faith, he gives an example of the faith without works position, and he compares it to demonic faith. You believe there's one God? Good for you. Good for you. You're just as good as the demons. The faith-only guy says, this is my faith. It's all well and good, but the demons believe in God, and they tremble. That's not saving faith. No demons are going to heaven. None. But then he says, let me show you my position. Let me give you the two people on my side. The first is the father of the Hebrews, the one who crossed over, the Hebrew, that's Abraham. And he says, he demonstrated his faith in God when he offered up Isaac on the altar. Do you remember what the writer of Hebrews says? He believed the promise of God, that God was able to raise him from the dead. He knew that Isaac was the child of promise, and he knew that he would have offspring by Isaac because God promised him that as many as there are sands in the sea and stars in the sky, he would have offspring, and it would be through the child of promise. So if he dies, he's coming back to life again. And Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness. So what did he do? He binds Isaac and puts him on the altar. And what did Rahab do? If the father of the Hebrews, which is such an incredible example of faith, had this kind of faith, what about Rahab, the wicked woman of Jericho, who's always in Scripture Rahab the prostitute, but she also received the messengers and then took care of them. And here we are reminded of her sinful past. So James is almost saying, look, as wicked as she was, as evil as she had been, her faith overcame that. And what kind of faith did she have? The kind of faith that demonstrated how she treated other people, that she had true saving faith in God. And now she's in the line of Christ. These examples, men and women, prove to us that you can have a profession of faith that's empty and hollow if it is a profession that does nothing. Or you can have a profession of faith that's genuine and real when your profession of faith does something. Because faith is always a right reaction to what God has revealed. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for your passage here that you've given to us.